Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
In our first season of Still, we explored a period of time in Fort Worth, Texas, between 1983 and 1986, when more than 20 women vanished and were later found murdered. Some were shot, some were strangled, some were bludgeoned to death. Most had been sexually assaulted, and sadly, few of their cases have ever been solved. Our investigation of this time period led us to focus on 7 specific cold cases: the rapes and murders of Mary Till, Sandra Bush, Catherine Davis, Cindy Heller, Angela Ewert, Sarah Koschka, and Terry McAdams. Through our research of known killers at the time, we homed in on a likely culprit. Curtis Don Brown was already serving a life sentence. He had raped and murdered 3 women. He died in a Texas prison in early 2021, before we could interview him. Now, we want to step back and discuss what listeners have shared with us about their theories and memories of that time of terror. In this bonus episode, we'll also be sharing unreleased tidbits of information, follow-up interviews, and a Q&A discussion with a special guest. From the pages of the Reporter's Notebook. This is Still. I'm your host, Gary Anderson. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our bonus episode of Still, Season 1. At the end of the season earlier this year, we asked listeners to share with us their thoughts about our story. Were there other killers out there we should have considered? Is there any evidence we missed? What cases should we tackle next? And boy, did you guys deliver. We want to begin with a discussion of potential suspects suggested by our listeners. While a number of names were brought to our attention, 4 in particular piqued our interest. The first comes courtesy of a special guest, fellow journalist and podcaster Claire Sanima. Claire met with us recently to discuss theories of our cases. I'm going to play some of that conversation for you. Wanted to start out with, tell us a little bit about you, tell us a little bit about your show, and just expound on that.
Thanks so much for having me, Gary. It's fun to be here in real life. I don't think we get to do that in the podcast world that much. So it's nice to be sitting across the table from you here chatting. I've been in the Dallas area for about 10 years now and, you know, really enjoy crime reporting. That's where I've found my place. I do it primarily for CBS News. I'm a development producer for the show 48 Hours, which airs on Saturday nights on CBS. And then I also do some crime. I've done some crime stories for 60 Minutes and the morning and evening shows as well. So pretty much all crime all the time. But I found a new love of podcast. And, you know, at first I was just a listener for many years. And then whenever I was approached about, you know, did I want to host my own podcast? Did I see myself in that space? You know, it was a gradual evolution. You know, one of those things where I was like, well, I really enjoy this as a consumer, you know, but I hadn't seen myself as someone who would be creating that content. And it took me a little while to warm up to the idea. But once I did, you know, I've really enjoyed it and see it as such a valuable medium. And so my first show is called Final Days on Earth, and the first season came out in April 2021, and it's on the life and death of Damien Hurd, who was a college wrestler who grew up not too far from where we are now in the Fort Worth area in Texas, but he got a college scholarship to Western Colorado University in Gunnison, and that, unfortunately, is where his life ended. And so my story goes to the final days of his life and tries to find answers for, you know, how he ended up dead at the age of 20. And many people have raised, you know, questions about that investigation and about the ruling in the case, which was suicide, but has been heavily disputed by his family. So my podcast ended up being 13 episodes, and we look at that case inside and out, backwards and forwards, and in every way in between.
If you haven't listened to Final Days on Earth, find it and add it to your playlist immediately. You won't be disappointed. We're going to discuss some details of Claire's podcast with her, but first, we wanted to dive right into our cases, particularly since Claire herself offered up a potential suspect that we found intriguing. This is Karen talking.
I wanted to ask you, Claire, you had mentioned a potential suspect for our cases, William Reese. And so I wanted to ask you to just tell us what you know about him and kind of why you think that he would be a viable suspect for our cases.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was listening to your episodes and you're going through the MO of the killer, and, you know, like you say in your podcast, it could be one killer, it could be multiple killers, but there's a lot of similarities in you know, the way the crimes are committed and who the victims are. And so it was interesting to me because the name that popped into my head was William Reese. And he was a truck driver and also works as like a ranch hand, worked a lot with horses. And his crimes, his first known crime was in 1986. And he was a truck driver. And so he would go from the Oklahoma City area, down into Texas, all the way from, you know, North Texas, going through Houston, going down to Galveston and back up to Oklahoma. So he really was on the road a lot and hit a lot of different cities and has a lot of victims in different cities across Oklahoma and Texas. And his seems to be his MO was to find women in distress on the roadway and offer to help. Many times the tire would have been changed. Other times women, you know, there's a case where a woman's car was flooded out in the water, you know, in a flash flood type situation. And he drove up in his 18-wheeler, like a knight in shining armor, and said, oh, get in the cab, you know, my car, I'll take you to a payphone. And so I was struck by the similarities of some of the women in the Fort Worth cases where they had car trouble, sometimes explained, sometimes unexplained. And William Reese, so he was, his first known case was 1986.
a young woman, a freshman at the University of Oklahoma, who has car trouble, and she survives. And he is actually put on trial in 1987 and goes to jail. It was a 25-year sentence, but he only served 10 years in the kidnapping case. And immediately when he gets out in 1997, he starts committing the same types of crimes. And he also is known to have committed murder as well. And there are cases where he would put, he would stand outside a gas station and he would post up there and watch for women to come in alone into the gas station. While they're in the gas station, he would go slash their tire, puncture their tire, and then he would follow them into the night, into the day, and you know, take it from there. And so that seemed to be a very similar MO to several of the cases that you looked at. And I just wondered, you know, if the timing lined up pre-1987 when he went into prison for the first time, if, you know, potentially as a truck driver, we could find out, you know, if his routes took him to the Fort Worth area.
The crimes that initially put William Reese behind bars occurred in the spring of 1986, around the same time Curtis Don Brown was committing one of his known crimes, the murder of Jewel Woods in Fort Worth. Reese, then a 26-year-old truck driver, picked up a 19-year-old college student in Norman, Oklahoma, under the pretense of helping her after her car had broken down. Once inside his truck, Reese tied her up and raped her and said his intention was to take her to Houston. At some point along the way, the victim escaped and survived the attack. While awaiting trial for that kidnapping, Reese raped another Oklahoma woman whom he followed home from a bar. Reese was convicted of both crimes and was sentenced to 25 years in an Oklahoma prison, but he only served 10, going free in October 1996. By July of 1997, he was passing through North Texas, this time committing murder in the city of Denton, just north of Fort Worth. Denton, if you recall, is where Sarah Koschka and her mother had moved to from Fort Worth. I don't want to confuse you, though. Sarah disappeared at the end of 1984, nearly 13 years before Reese kidnapped a victim from Denton. But it's notable because he was definitely in North Texas as he hunted for and found a victim.
Right, and one of his victims actually was in Denton, correct?
That's right, Kelly Cox. That was an unsolved case for many years. That was a 1997 case. If people aren't familiar with that, unbelievably tragic and just a really hard case because that young woman was actually touring the Denton County Jail that morning with her criminology class at the University of North Texas. But whenever she got out of the tour of the jail, she realized she had actually locked her keys in her car. So she wasn't able to get in. And this is, I don't believe she had a cell phone at this time. This was 1997, pre-cell phone. So she tried to go use the phone at the jail and they turned her away. And so she went to a gas station to buy a Coke, to get some change, to use a payphone. And that's where she had the unbelievably unfortunate chance encounter with William Reese. She allegedly spilled a Coke on him, and that led to her kidnapping and murder. So it's definitely true that he was in North Texas and that he was at a gas station and found a young woman that, you know, was never seen alive again. So he seems like a good suspect in a number of ways.
The 1997 murder of Kelly Cox was a case that our associate producer, Christine Hughes, was personally aware of. Christine talked to Claire, Karen, and I through Zoom.
I actually remember the Kelly Cox case. I was editor of a newspaper in that region at the time that it happened, so we covered it. And she was also a young mother. She had a child, and that was really a tragic thing for her family. And it took a long time for them to solve that case. So she was not found for a while, and also he was not identified for a while.
Is it possible that William Reese sabotaged Angela Ewart's car that night at the 7-Eleven in 1984? Was he watching her from somewhere nearby? Perhaps. Another person of interest is an unknown assailant who attempted to abduct a young woman in southwest Fort Worth at around the same time as Angie's and Sarah's abductions in December of 1984. The kidnapping attempt was even in the same Wedgwood neighborhood where both Sarah and Angie were last seen alive. It was also just a mile or two from where Catherine Davis and Cindy Heller each disappeared. Tria Foster, known as Tria Regester at the time, lived with her grandparents in the Wedgwood area and was friends with Sarah Koschka. We talked with her by phone about what happened.
When someone attempted to abduct you, was that there in that neighborhood?
Yes. Yes. Right catty corner from my grandparents' house. So I was walking to my friend's house that was kind of down that hill on the way to where those apartments were. And I was, you know, I had just crossed Trail Lake and it was right there at that corner. And a guy drove up and I could have sworn it was like a green, I've heard the details or listened to the podcast and it's saying that he was in a blue truck. I remember it being a green truck, a greenish truck that was kind of rusty or older. And he pulled up and he said, get in. And I immediately went, because I was always taught, just like, go walk into a house, you know, to act like you live there. I couldn't get in. So I sat on the back of a car because everything's had like carports over there. They don't really have garages. So I sat like where he couldn't see me, but I guess my legs were there and he was still there. And he goes, I'm not leaving. You might as well get in. I'm not going anywhere. And I know where you live. And so I just kind of sat there for a long time and I kind of kept looking, like I need to make a run for it. But I was afraid that he could get out and get me because he was like reaching in his pocket, like maybe he had a gun or something like that. A car pulled up behind him. And I want to say it was like a station wagon because he was kind of in the middle of the road. He had to pull up a little bit. And that's when I took off and ran to my grandparents' house. But yeah, I remember him having kind of, you know, shoulder length brown hair. Had a, I want to say like an army green jacket on. Don't remember color of eyes or anything like that, but I remember it's sandy brown hair, kind of long. And then the older greenish truck.
As it turns out, another friend of Tria's had an encounter with a man fitting that same description.
My girlfriend that I was walking to, somebody was following her in a similar truck when she was on her bicycle. And that was right up from where my grandparents was. So, and that was probably a month after that, what happened with me.
So was that,
so I think he was in that area for a while.
The person that followed her, was it the same type of truck, same description?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay. I don't think they called the police and he didn't stop and try to do anything, but her mom called my grandmother and had a long conversation about it. And like neither of us were really allowed to walk or ride our bikes around there anymore.
And this was in broad daylight, correct?
Broad daylight. No, this was the middle of the day. This was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay.
On like a Saturday.
Is it possible this is the assailant who abducted and murdered Sarah Koschka? Remember, we told you in episode 2 that a car was stolen from the Wedgwood area the same night that Sarah went missing. That car was later found abandoned somewhere in Dallas. We're not sure if it was the same part of Dallas where Sarah's body was found, but the vehicle was not a pickup truck. Tria gave us some of her thoughts about Sarah.
We would talk on the phone all the time. She was like my confidant person because she was older and always, you know, gave advice and stuff like that. So she was older. She was also kind of more, you know, she was not somebody you really messed with. That's the reason I just remember that being like really surprised. Like she knew this person or she would have put up a fight, I think, knowing who she is.
While Tria's experience may help shed light on Sarah's abduction and murder, and maybe even Angie Ewart's, it does little to help explain the other cases.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
A third potential suspect was brought to our attention by a listener who messaged us on Facebook. In January of 1978, 17-year-old Leisha McGee was brutally murdered. After she didn't return home late one evening, her car was found abandoned on the side of the highway, and her body was found in the trunk. Although her murder happened several years before the cases we have discussed in our first season, Leisha lived in southwest Fort Worth, and her car and body were recovered along the same route Angie Ewert was driving the night she pulled over with a flat tire and then vanished. Leisha McGee's killer has never been officially identified. However, a cigarette butt left in Leisha's car led investigators years later to a Fort Worth man who was in prison for aggravated assault. That man is Robin Dwayne Carter. This is Karen.
And DNA recovered from those cigarettes were tied both to the victim and to Robin Carter. And although Robin lived in the same neighborhood as the victim, he says that they did not have any interaction with each other, that they had never really met or talked or hung out, anything like that. So there was no reason for his DNA to be on a cigarette butt inside her vehicle. But police say the cigarette butt was there, the DNA is a positive result, and that's how they tracked it to him.
Carter is scheduled to be released on parole after serving a prison term for severely injuring a woman in 1995 in a Fort Worth suburb. Prosecutors said he deliberately hit the woman with a pickup he was driving while she was out for a walk. The woman survived, but required 5 surgeries and months of physical therapy to recover. It wasn't Robin Carter's first brush with the law. His rap sheet dates back to his teen years. When he was just 16, he was charged with attacking a 24-year-old seminary student who, notably, was having car trouble. That crime happened just days after Leisha McGee was murdered. Carter later got into trouble for marijuana possession, DWI, and burglary of a vehicle. In 1987, he went on an hours-long crime spree that included carjacking, theft, and aggravated robbery. He committed this string of crimes in Fort Worth and neighboring Benbrook. Carter was originally a person of interest in Leisha McGee's murder, but he was never charged. Then, in 2009, Carter's DNA returned a CODIS hit when compared with the DNA of the cigarette butt from Leisha's car. It's also noteworthy that it was in December of 1977 when he stole a seminary student's car during his attack on her. He was arrested after he wrecked the vehicle on a neighborhood street. Less than 2 months later, Leisha McGee was on her way home from visiting friends on the same street that Carter wrecked the stolen car when she was attacked and killed.
The strange thing, though, is that the prosecutor is not going to bring this to trial unless new evidence comes forward, because the existence of the DNA on the cigarette butt, he says, is not enough for a conviction. And he's afraid of losing the case because all of his other convictions and the circumstantial evidence, the prosecutor says, would not be admissible in court.
So was Robin Carter, who lived near the Wedgwood area in the late 70s and early 80s, only a few streets away from Lisha McGee, responsible for the 1984 disappearances of Angela Ewart, Sarah Koschka, and Cindy Heller? It's certainly possible, but we feel that it's unlikely. In all of our 7 cold cases, sexual assault appears to be a motivating factor, one that is an established pattern for Curtis Don Brown. It does not appear that Lisha McGee was sexually assaulted. That leads me to a question that I wanted to ask Claire. Have you encountered a lot in the work that you've done where prosecutors and investigators are at odds? And how, as a reporter, do you approach that and try to tell that story and tell both sides of that story?
Yeah, it's a challenge whenever there isn't a clear runaway suspect that's head and shoulders above the rest. But in our experience, in my experience, typically, you know, they reserve the suspect for when they have, you know, their clear guy, you know, in their law enforcement eyes, in the eyes of the state, that will soon be a defendant, then they'll call them the suspect. And before that, you know, it's persons of interest. And that can be a difficult area to come in as a reporter and talk about persons of interest because you want to be fair to everyone.
A fourth potential suspect that we wish we would have taken a closer look at before now is Glenn Samuel McCurley Jr. Earlier this year, McCurley was convicted of the 1974 kidnapping and murder of 17-year-old Carla Walker. He dragged her from a car in a Fort Worth bowling alley parking lot, bludgeoned her boyfriend until he lost consciousness, and then took Carla about 10 miles south to rape and strangle her. He left her body in a culvert near a lake. Like Robin Carter, McCurley had a prior conviction of car theft from his younger days. Also like Carter, McCurley had surfaced on detectives' radar not long after the murder, but they were never able to definitively link him to the case. However, in 2020, new DNA testing produced conclusive evidence. Now, detectives are reviewing other cold cases to see if any evidence remains that could be tested against McCurley's DNA. Glenn McCurley moved to Fort Worth in 1972 and was free to commit crimes until his arrest last year. In 1978, he and his wife bought a house in a neighborhood just northwest of the Wedgwood area, and he still lived there when he was arrested. The house is less than a 10-minute drive from the spots where Catherine Davis, Cindy Heller, Angie Ewart, and Sarah Koschka were all taken. It's also really interesting that when McCurley was arrested for a car theft back in 1961, he had also stolen that vehicle from a bowling alley parking lot. And his known victim, Carla Walker, was kidnapped from a bowling alley parking lot in another part of town. Wedgwood Bowl, which touted in 1984 newspaper ads that it sold soft drinks for a quarter and hot dogs for 50 cents, was just down the hill from the gas station where Angie Ewart bought gas the night she was taken, and directly across the street from where Sarah Koschka was last seen alive. McCurley didn't live as close to the spots where these women vanished as Curtis Don Brown did, but he's a very viable person of interest. And like Curtis Brown, McCurley spent time as a teenager in a boys' home. He, too, clearly had a troubled childhood. It was in the interest of fairness that we didn't spend a lot of time in the podcast discussing a person who was arrested in 1985, specifically in connection with Sarah Koschka's murder. That person was Remsen Wolf, who we mentioned briefly in episode 4 when we discussed possible suspects. Wolf, if you recall, was the son of wealthy and well-known New Yorkers. He found his way to Fort Worth, Texas, where he later became embroiled in a child molestation charge in 1983, a charge that, while later dropped, was still pending when he was arrested in 1985. We spent a great deal of time investigating Remsen Wolf. However, like the police task force in 1985, we could find nothing that substantiated him as a viable suspect, despite the unusual circumstances surrounding him. Not long after Wolf was released, he returned to New York, and we can't find any reports of crimes he was later associated with. After Wolf died in 1998, the contents of a storage unit filled with his belongings went up for auction. We reached out to the owner and manager of that storage facility to determine if, by chance, any of the contents were cataloged before the auction. We never received a response. Similarly, we have been unable to determine what became of Curtis Don Brown's belongings after he died in prison earlier this year. We have filed a request for that information from the Texas Department of Corrections. It is still pending, and we will, of course, let you know if we discover anything important. In both cases, it's possible that materials left behind by either of these men could shed light on their involvement, if any, in these mysterious cold cases. Since Claire Santamol was gracious enough to share some time with us, we wanted to get her general opinions as a listener of our podcast about her thoughts on this 1980s murder spree. Are you shocked to think about what happened in the 80s and, like, oh my gosh, who knew? I mean, what were your reactions to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I had no idea that there was this, extremely fraught situation for women traveling alone in their cars in the DFW area, in the 80s, that was like a daily concern. That, several of the people that you interviewed on your podcast talked about just the feeling of panic and anxiety. And, like you said, this is the age before cell phones. And so the idea that, if you get into car trouble, it's potentially a life-threatening situation is terrifying. And, as a crime reporter who's cynical and everything else, I always tell my friends, if you get a flat tire, just drive on the rim until you can get somewhere. Do not pull over on the side of the road. Like, it's not worth it. Like, if it's dark and you're alone, just get somewhere with other people and hopefully some security cameras and all that good stuff, because, stranger danger is rare, but there's certain circumstances that can make it, much more likely that you could, become a target of these absolutely, just unbelievable. It's hard to call them bad luck, but, if you just happen to come across the path of someone who, wishes harm and you're in a vulnerable situation, it can end very badly. And, just trying to not live your life in fear, but also just recognizing, maybe I'm just going to push it and get to that gas station or get to somewhere where, there'll be other people around. I think that's good advice even in 2021.
Let's talk about DNA evidence. We're constantly trying to push and find ways to get evidence that can be tested for DNA, whether it matches Curtis Don Brown or not. Our goal is to find out, who the killer was. Have you encountered that in the stories that you've covered? How does DNA evidence play into anything that you've covered? Anything interesting that you've encountered along those lines as you've been a crime reporter for so long?
Yeah, probably some of the more interesting cases are where they've had DNA and they've used it to create a suspect profile. There's a place called Paraben Labs, and they can actually take, if it's a good enough of a DNA sample, they can take it and create a sketch of the victim. And that is just fascinating. By, the features of the DNA, they're able to say, this is what the person's facial structure looks like. This is their race. This is their eye color, hair color. In some cases, the picture that they have drawn looks like a drawing of someone's driver's license picture. And it has solved crimes. They have solved multiple cases across the country. And it's a developing technology, but it's one that law enforcement, you know, is relying on, especially in cases where they have a good DNA profile and they don't have a suspect. You know, it's a way to get, you know, like an artist's rendering of a suspect. And a lot of times they do that and they put it out in the public, in the media, and people call in because they recognize the person. That's how accurate it can be.
As we shared in our final episode last March, Arlington police are still trying to solve the murder of Terry McAdams, the UTA student found brutally killed in her boyfriend's apartment on Valentine's Day, 1985. We believe that because Terry and Sarah Koska were found within days of their murders, their cases may have the best chance of being solved through DNA if sufficient evidence was saved. We pray that remaining DNA could be used to build a suspect rendering like the one Claire just described. I want to mention, too, that a foundation associated with the Fort Worth Police Department has been set up as a way for donors to help pay for new, more advanced DNA testing of evidence from Fort Worth cold cases. If you're interested, you can make a donation online at fwpdcoldcasessupport.org. That's FWPD for Fort Worth Police Department, coldcasesupport.org. We'll include a link in our show notes. Now I want to ask you a question about Final Days. The question I was going to ask you today was about the cognitive interview that you wanted to conduct with Linda. If you haven't yet listened to Final Days on Earth, Linda Nienhauser was a Colorado hiker who saw the body of Damien Hurd from a distance the day after he went missing from a late-night college party in 2014. As Claire reveals in a bonus episode that came out last August, Linda Nienhauser, who had earlier agreed to undergo a cognitive interview, unfortunately died of cancer in January 2021, before that interview could happen.
That is so true, and it was heartbreaking. So the idea of a cognitive interview is that it's not using hypnosis. It's just using memory aids and techniques that trauma therapists use. For people to go back in the recesses of their mind and recall usually traumatic events that, for the most part, they really do have a place in your brain that, for your own emotional health and protection, that you block off. And there are ways, there's relaxation exercises that have been proven to help you access those memories. And, you know, it's often used with people who have endured trauma. You know, it can be used with children who have seen something and, you know, it's imprinted on them. And 10 years later, 5 years later, whatever it may be, you know, they're able to recall it with pretty good, you know, clarity. And forensic artists have used it with women and other people who've been attacked. And they don't, they think they can't remember anything about their attacker, but they're able to go back to that place, put themselves in that moment. A lot of it has to do with, you know, like I said, relaxation, and then also, you know, building that memory piece by piece. You know, do you remember what you were wearing? Do you remember where you were sitting? Do you remember, you know, what time of day it was? And it really does help you, to get back to that place and to pull up, you know, those memories in your mind. And there have been, you know, proven, it is somewhat controversial. There will always be people that you know, don't support it, don't believe in it. But it has been used, you know, in criminal cases and court cases by, you know, authorities.
Not being able to conduct a cognitive interview with Linda Nienhauser is a big setback in Claire's mission to uncover exactly how Damien Hurd died. In her podcast, she talks about how she has waffled over the years, trying to make sense of a very strange situation. Given my own feelings about what happened to Damien, I just had to ask Claire where she stands today. So the final question that I want to ask you about Final Days, I'll be honest, the first two or three episodes, I kept going, man, Claire's reaching.
Claire's reaching. This kid just killed himself. He just killed himself. Now I'm not sure. There's just so much there. There's just so much inconsistencies. I'm just not sure. Is that where you land today?
You know, I really do go back and forth on my theories and what I believe. You know, the place that I feel that I'm in today is we deserve more answers. His family deserves more answers. And it seems to me that they could be given those answers if people would come forward and talk about the ID card usage, if they would talk about, you know, if we could identify who was driving that white truck that day at Cabin Creek and who was using those bicycles. I believe that there could be innocent explanations for all of it, but we need to hear it.
As we ended our conversation, Claire had a question for us.
I was so glad to find your podcast because it's so well produced and it's such an interesting story and really opened my eyes to a trend that was going on in DFW that, you know, I had no idea about. And, you know, I guess, was this, were these unsolved cases things that you had worked on previously in your career and you had, how did you find your topic for Still for season one?
So that's one of the things that Christine and I debate about because we can't remember exactly who first found these cases. I think it was her. She thinks it was me.
Part of it was also the fact that we grew up in DFW. We were alive when that was going on. We were living in the Dallas area, not Fort Worth. And so we were oblivious to what was happening in Fort Worth. So as she really started diving in, as Christine started diving in, and we would just start talking about it, I just kept getting mortified. I kept going, my God, we were here. We lived through this. How did I not hear a thing about all of these women being found murdered and missing in you know, just 30 miles down the road when I was a junior and senior in high school? So that was the personal connection for me. I think you kind of felt the same way, but it just grew into something that we felt really passionate about, I would say.
I was those women. I was those women at that time. I was the same age. I had the same experiences with college. I went to the same nightclubs, and I heard about them on the news at the time, and you know, thought about myself and my safety as a result. So for me, it was extremely personal.
Well, Claire, it's been a real pleasure. We thank you for making the trek over to our neck of the woods. And thank you so much for being willing to spend your afternoon with us.
So this was very interesting. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
So, with season one behind us, many of you have asked, what's next? For season two, we're moving to a different cold case. Well, actually, it's two cold cases, both of which take us to the Pacific Northwest. First, we have a woman who vanished and was presumably murdered in 1976. And then there is a woman's body that was found in the area almost exactly 2 years later. Like everyone associated with the cases, we're trying to figure it out. Is this the same woman? With DNA and modern forensics, that should be easy, right? What could have happened that has kept those long-awaited answers hidden for so long? Join us January 27th for Season 2 of Still. Anyone with information pertaining to any of the murders in Season 1 should contact the Fort Worth Police Department's Cold Case Unit at coldcase@fortworthpd.com. Still is a production of The Reporter's Notebook and Grayson Shaw Media. You can connect with us online at thereportersnotebook.com or via email at info@thereportersnotebook.com. Still was researched, written, and produced by Karen Shaw Anderson.
Research was also provided by associate producer Christine Hughes. Original music by Smith Uoso. I'm your host and associate producer, Gary Anderson. Special thanks to Claire Sanima, host and producer of Final Days on Earth. Like, follow, and subscribe to Still on your favorite podcast platform, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram to join the conversation. Lamentations 3:21. Yet I still dare to hope when I remember this.